welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, here for episode 63 and a very special PASIC 2017 preview number two, a real true preview show. Aren't you excited? You should be excited. You should be excited! You're going to hear snippets of conversations from four guests, all of whom are presenting at PASIC 2017, in the order in which they will appear at PASIC. You will hear from Gwen Deese, Haley Nutt, Emily Tannert-Patterson, and Lamon Lawhorn. First up, Gwen Deese. Gwen is the professor of percussion at Michigan State University, and her percussion ensemble is one of the winners of IPEC. Her group is playing in what I think is one of the prime spots, 10 a.m. Thursday morning in the Sagamore Ballroom. Here's Gwen talking about her group's concert.
Tell me about is this the first time that your group has played at PASIC?
It's not. It's actually the second time.
Okay. What was the, tell me about the process and getting ready for that, for this, you know, group to get ready to play.
For like this time?
Yes, for this time around.
Yeah.
And compare it to the last time.
Okay. So last time we won 4 years ago. So we won in 2013. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was first time playing, and that one was almost a little easier to figure out, like repertoire wise, because we had put some pieces on our tape, and almost all of the personnel for those pieces were going to come back. Mm. And so the pieces had done really well. So I just thought, like, I want to keep putting those on the concert. And then we commissioned a new piece and I think added one extra thing, and that was it. That was pretty easy to have that concert. This one, and actually preparing for that one, we prepared super hard. Everybody rehearsed 4 to 5 days a week for 2 hours. I was there at everything. It was a crazy schedule. I really didn't do anything else for like a couple months. We had a lot of guests in. And this time around, I did something similar as far as the tape goes. We had a couple pieces on the tape that we had enough people coming back to be able to perform them, and because they had done well on the tape, I wanted to put them on the PASIC concert. But one of the pieces, we didn't have enough personnel coming back, and so I wasn't sure that one would work out. And I've also wanted to try to highlight some of the student accomplishments this time. So for example, one of the pieces is by a guy who just graduated, who was a percussionist and composer. And that was one of the pieces on our tape. And Josh Trinity. And his piece is Luminescent Experiments, which is a pretty cool piece. I was going to say sort of like a little softer and spacey, but not necessarily. It kind of takes you on like a journey of different colors and things. It's really cool. And then we have a doctoral student who is almost done, but he got a job last year, so he's finishing remotely, who has also been doing some composing, and he wrote a really interesting piece that's kind of theatrical, and it's one that I would have wanted to put on the tape, but it just doesn't work unless it's a video, if you can like see what's mm-hmm. happening. So yeah. We're going to do that one. And then another doctoral student recently commissioned a piece by Andrea Clearfield, which is a super cool piece, so I wanted to put that on there. And then another piece from our tape was the Andy Kehoe Quartet, Pillar 4, that I was part of commissioning. And so I just wanted to put that on there since that had done well on the tape. And then we are getting a new piece from a new MSU faculty composer, Dave Biedenbender. So it's pretty different in the sense that everything is very new. The oldest piece is 3 years old. And the preparation is also different because with my daughter, there's just no way I can be at 4 to 5 rehearsals a week of 5 different pieces.
Not unless you have her play, if there's a part that she can cover, I mean, you know.
There could be a part that she could cover, yeah. Last time we were doing 10 to midnight every night of like of Poe when we were working on that. So that doesn't really work out this time, but, but it's still working and everybody's on top of their stuff. And I think it should be a cool concert, but
yeah. I'm just, trying to find a way to get,
incorporate her in there.
There's gotta be something she could, there's gotta be a couple parts. I figure, we'll see where her technique is at. I'm sure it's coming along.
She likes drums. So, there you go.
There you go. I mean, it might not come across on tape very well, but boy, the video is going to be tremendous.
Exactly.
And because this is your second time, going to PASIC with Michigan State, do you feel like, and I'm thinking about the percussion ensemble concerts that the college, do those things feel like mandatory events for you? For your studio, because you do, in terms of like the other ones and when you, on other years, do you feel a pressure to have to go because you're a program that has gotten your group there and in that sense?
Like, do I feel pressure to go to see other people?
Maybe? Yes. Or to see what other, to kind of, I don't know if you compare, but you see what other studios are doing.
Yeah, I don't know if I feel pressure, but I definitely feel it makes me more curious, especially since I know, what we've kind of gone through to do this, and it makes me curious, like, what did somebody else think was like the best thing to program, or what are other studios playing? And then all studios are super different with like the size and like type of repertoire. So yeah, I do definitely feel very curious. And even if I'm like, oh man, I really want to sleep in or something, I'll be like, no, I need to see. Like, if I leave and I don't know, then it'll bother me,
Okay.
Yeah.
I just wonder that, because it seems like I was at a very small school for a number of years, and it was never a program that was going to, mm-hmm. It was not that kind, just not that kind of program necessarily. Right. But I always feel like it's, that you go to those concerts and you could kind of see, like, you tend to look around the crowd and you see people at large percussion programs, mm-hmm. who this is the goal is to go. And you just think, like, are they there because, same thing, are they there because they're curious, or are they there because they have to, it's like a competitive thing? I didn't know if you had thought of that or if that had.
I mean, I think the main thing I've thought of is that I always want to see, and I mean, I think that probably is an element of competition. If somebody's playing like the exact same type of repertoire or even like the same piece or something, I might be like, okay, I need to know like how we compare, but it's more just like really curious, because it's just so easy to get stuck in your own thing, and I just want to know like what everybody else is doing.
Next up, Haley Nutt. Haley is a doctoral student of musicology and a percussionist at Florida State University. Haley is giving an oral presentation called From Piano to Percussion, The Emergence of Women Percussion Composers in the 20th Century at 1 p.m. Thursday afternoon in room 204. Here's Haley talking about her research.
All right, Haley, tell me about your presentation. And include like when and where too as well.
Okay, yeah. So my paper, it's not really a paper. It's more of just a casual talk. It's titled From Piano to Percussion, The Emergence of Women Percussion Composers in the 20th Century. And I'm presenting that at PASIC on Thursday at 1 p.m. I want to say there's some room designated to kind of the research, and I believe it's like room 204 or something.
Yeah.
But it's the researchy things that at 1 p.m.
When it was explained what your what the style of the presentation is, you said it casual talk. Did they give you any pointers as to what that meant?
No. So I'm coming from the field of musicology, and I've presented a couple of papers in that realm. And with that, it's very much, you have a paper that is typed that you read from, and you don't really deviate from this written prose, basically. But as soon as I, actually when I got accepted for PASIC, I was in a rehearsal with Dr. John Starks at FSU, and I told him that I had gotten accepted, and immediately he was like, don't read off of the paper. And I was like, oh, why? And he was like, you know, it's a different audience, you don't want people to fall asleep on you, and he's like, if you can, you know, I'm not telling you that you don't, like, definitely don't read from paper, but you'll have a better audience, it's more interactive if you're able to just kind of present it, you know, not from just a script type of thing. So that's my goal with this, just to be a little bit more, you know, moving around, kind of using my teacher persona a little bit, to get everyone interested and engaged.
Right. That's because you're working in musicology as well, that mm-hmm. I've been told, I remember taking, when I was in grad school, taking a musicology class that I had to, and the teacher, I tried to do like the branching out thing, like I was typical, and then I noticed that everybody else did, like, read the paper.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. There's just different fields that do it a different way, and just trying to figure out what that way is going to obviously help you with your audience. So.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that he told you that right off the bat, because...
Yes. Yeah, I mean, because an hour, in the past I've done some, like, usually at, like, conferences for musicology, papers are about 20 minutes and then, like, 10 minutes for Q&A. So I found out that I'm presenting for an hour, and I was like, oh my goodness, that's, you know, a lot more time to deal with and stuff. But, yeah, I'm actually, I'm presenting this paper for my musicology department tomorrow. To kind of get their feedback and see how it goes. But I feel really good about it, and I'm really excited for next week for sure.
Yeah. And you have a good time. You're done in the afternoon on Thursday.
I know. Yeah, originally they had me on Friday, and then I guess they had some kind of conflict, so they changed it to Thursday, and I was like, well, hopefully everyone's there by that point. That's another thing. You know, some people are still getting there on Thursday. But yeah, once I'm done with that, I just get to enjoy Indianapolis and enjoy the rest of the convention. So,
and you still got your little tag on your badge that says presenter, or
right? Definitely.
No, I already presented, so it still says it.
Yeah.
So how did you get into the topic? What, first of all, what is the topic? And again, and then what was the kind of the way your way in on it?
Sure. Yeah. And I'll kind of I kind of introduce my discussion from kind of showing, telling people how I got to where I am with this topic. But it's basically a part of my thesis that I did for my master's. So I finished my master's in musicology this past spring, so now I'm starting my doctorate. So all the material is something that I've already, you know, researched thoroughly in my thesis. And yeah, it's kind of, you know, unfortunately I only have an hour, so I can't present my entire thesis, but it's kind of the bulk of the argument, the really most important musicological look at kind of the development of percussion and percussion ensemble in the 20th century, and kind of how women have fit into that or not fit into that. But yeah, I mean, I went to TCU, Texas Christian University, for my undergrad, so huge focus on percussion ensemble. Then I come to FSU, and it's kind of the same environment, a little bit more chamber stuff, but still we do, and I played in the percussion ensemble all through my master's here, took lessons with Park, so I'm still very involved with percussion. So, you know, two big schools with, you know, big names in the percussion ensemble world. So my, you know, interest in that specific genre has just continued to rise. But yeah, so it's a little bit about, just basically a little bit of my thesis research. The part that I'm most excited and really feel like I need to share with the percussion world.
Is there a lot of related research here, or is this almost, were you almost flying blind?
Yeah, I didn't have a lot to go from. So I do have a chapter in my thesis that's, you know, just like the history of percussion. So of course, like John Beck's work, those sort of like encyclopedia things, of course, were very helpful. But yeah, when I got to kind of the musicological stuff, I was looking, you know, just kind of to other females a little broadly in classical music, kind of the most important genre is this modernism music, kind of the breakaway from romantic music that I'll talk a lot about, but just kind of how women were involved in that and how I can kind of see this parallel in percussion. But yeah, it was a lot of kind of, it's a lot of new kind of, I don't know if I'll say groundbreaking, but it's a lot of new ideas that I haven't seen anyone else do so far. So.
And are you, as much as you can, are you in touch with these composers?
So, the people that I wrote for my thesis, people that were had pieces premiered by Paul Price, who I'll be talking about, who was the first percussion ensemble guy, basically, at Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, later at Manhattan. And so, unfortunately, most of those, this was in the 50s, 60s, and I focus on three, and two of them have already passed away. But one of them actually lives in Florida, and I did a phone interview with her. So I was able to contact her and get her take on that, and that was really helpful. But definitely in the future, when I think I want to go in a more direction, more contemporary percussionist, of course, absolutely talking to them, doing more of like the ethnographic side of musicology, you know, getting their take is going to be crucial for that.
How much of the of what you were found in your research dealt with just barriers and obstacles versus finding the work?
You can kind of see that these women are a little bit obscure in the large scope of things. So one of the hardest parts for me in this in my project for my thesis was trying to find enough biographical information. So I focused on basically three women that had pieces that were premiered by Paul Price kind of in the early part of his career. And those three, it was Vivian Fine, who's kind of the most well-known composer, who there's a biography written about her. She has an active website, even though she passed away in the late 90s, I believe. But that one was quite easy to kind of write a streamlined biography on her and to kind of understand what part of her life affected her styles of music. Then the next one that I wrote about is Zita Carno, who's most well-known as a pianist for the Los Angeles Philharmonic for about 30 years until about 2000. And thankfully she is still alive. So she lives in Tampa. So I was able to contact her and we did a phone interview. But as far as like information on her on the computer, books and whatnot, is fairly limited. And then the last lady that I wrote about was Gita Steiner, who, it's definitely the most obscure. She died like kind of young, like early 50s. And, you know, mostly what I found was just bits and pieces from different websites, little blurbs on encyclopedias. Even, you know, she did one interview for Unpercussive Notes. There's like one published that was really helpful, and I found all these names, different people in the percussion world, and I tried to reach out to many of them that are still very active. I was like, could you tell me anything about her? And I don't remember now who wrote me back, but he was like, yeah, like Gita Steiner was just a really mysterious person, so I don't really know anything about her life, but her music was great. And I was like, okay, well, that's not super helpful. But yeah, it was kind of like the three women I chose, it went from easier, not easy, but easier to extremely difficult, just kind of their ability to really break through kind of the mainstream classical music as composers. So those were definitely challenges for me.
When you say fairly limited, do you mean zip, like a name? Is that what you mean?
No, there was, so Gita Steiner, there was maybe, I think it was like an encyclopedia of like American women composers. And I think it had like four sentences on her. So it was like, you know, I had her full name. I had a birth and death date. I had like a couple of her early pieces. I had where she did her schooling. And that was about it.
Yeah.
But with her, it was kind of cool. Like I said, she immigrated from Prague. She was about, you know, just a child, 7 or 8 or something. And I was able to look at, like, the ship manifest online. Those records are available. So that was kind of just a really neat research tool that I hadn't used before, that I was like, oh, I guess I can look on here to, you know, check dates, find her parents' names, even though after I searched their parents' names, I didn't really find anything else. But just having some names of their parents was at least another small biographical information that I was able to acquire. But so, yeah, I definitely felt at times it was just like, I don't know, I felt like, I don't know, I guess like a spy or something. I don't know, just trying to piece together everything. But it was fun. I enjoy it, so.
That's good.
Yeah.
Was it annoying that you had to, that it was, some of these things are so, and some of these women's lives or anything about them is so hard to find?
Of course at times it was frustrating, but I guess since, you know, this is a beginning, like I worked with a 2-year master's degree, and for most of that I'm working on this document, and this is really the first time that I'm involved with musicology at all. Like, you know, I did my undergrad in percussion and music ed. And so this was really just kind of my first interaction, learning how to research. And I actually worked as a research assistant for my professor that became my thesis advisor, and I did research for her. So that was actually really helpful. That was like my first semester here, just getting used to what I had, like databases and stuff that I had available for myself to, you know, look into. Of course, we have a great music library, and the librarian is really helpful. So really, for the most part, yes, there were frustrating parts, but it was really exciting and fun for me for probably like 80-85% of the time, honestly. I really enjoyed, you know, searching and finding these pieces of information and having that like eureka moment where I finally make, just even if it's a small breakthrough, it's still a breakthrough nonetheless. And I really enjoy that. And I guess that's part of the reason that I do what I do. So I guess it works out.
Who was the kind of the first wave that you even thought about doing this topic, or who was the first entry point?
It was definitely with Paul Price. I had kind of learned, you know, basic history of percussion ensemble while at TCU doing my undergrad. And, you know, percussion, we call it percussion orchestra, which is the term that we took from Richard Gibson, who is now at TCU as the director. So I was just really, you know, interested in these large percussion ensemble works and why it's a percussion orchestra. And every time I mentioned this concept to musicologists, they just looked at me funny and they had no idea what I was talking about. So I knew that this was new, and I had written, you know, little papers on like the history of the vibraphone and these just kind of basic historical, you know, timelines of instruments and that sort of thing. So that was definitely a direction I wanted to go. But and I talk about this in my my lecture, but it's what I found. So I found out a lot more about Paul Price, and I found his collection. It's at the Sousa Center for American Music at Illinois. And his archive has so much material. And I kind of found that, and this was actually at PASIC 2 years ago when it was in Texas, but that was 2015. And I met up with Bill Mersch, who's at Illinois. And so I asked him, I was like, what do you know about this archive? Has anyone worked with it? You know, is there anything that you think needs to be done with it? And he was like, yes, something needs to be done with it. Nobody has touched it. There's so much information in there, and there's a lot of errors in like the, you know, the detail, like the finding aid or like the script of what all is in there. Some of it is incorrect, some small details. And there's also all these reel-to-reel tapes that have been sitting and getting dust and becoming more fragile basically by the day. And he was like, someone really needs to digitize these. There's all this information, all these recordings. They're just kind of sitting there and going to waste. So really after talking to him and seeing that nothing had been done with this, that's really the direction I wanted to go. And then that led me to looking at kind of who the composers were, because most of the collection are pieces of music that were sent to him from all over the world, basically like, oh, you have a percussion ensemble. I wrote this percussion ensemble piece. Would you play it or would you publish it? Because he had a publishing company, or any of those options. And yeah, eventually it was really like I, you know, was studying this collection. The finding aid was online, so I was just searching it. And like, I want to do something with this. I don't know what direction. I can't do it all just for a thesis. There's way too much information. But yeah, and it was just kind of one day I was like, well, there's a couple women in here. So I wonder how many women are in here and how many like total you know, and so I counted those and started looking into who these women were, and yeah, it just kind of fell into place. And yeah, I guess as soon as I found more about the women, I just, yeah, kept, was kind of pulled in that direction to go with the talk about gender and all of that. I guess being a female myself, kind of understanding where they're coming from, just, you know, not just a few decades before me, but quite a few decades, but not, you know, not super long ago. So, yeah, I kind of felt like I sympathized and empathized with them as females trying to enter, you know, not only the field of composition, which is male dominated and very difficult to enter as a female, but also with percussion. So kind of this double difficulty in a way. So it was really fascinating when I started to see all this.
In working through the gender aspect, did you also research parts of like the gender, some of the gender research that's not related to percussion or composition?
Oh, a lot of, well, I've definitely come at it from musicology, and there's quite a few, especially in these last, since like 1990 is kind of when we had a change in direction of musicology research. And there's a lot more gender topics and themes being examined for the first time, really. And I was introduced to a lot of that material, you know, just taking courses about, you know, like an introduction to musicology courses and reading through this and kind of seeing, and most of this stuff, a lot of musicologists mostly focus on composers. So this was like a lot of composers, and I, you know, there were so many parallels between that and like percussion, these similar obstacles. So, yeah, and I've read a little bit about, you know, just cultural, like American and like Western cultural gender issues more broadly. That's definitely something that I hope to continue looking into, maybe taking like a women's studies course at SU in that department, breaking away from music specifically. But so far that's kind of been where I've centered myself.
I said, if you're looking for material to expand the paper, you could veer in that direction.
Right, absolutely, yes. I mean, any option, I'll definitely consider.
Appearing next is Emily Tannert Patterson. Emily is the percussion specialist for Rouse High School and Wiley Middle School in Leander, Texas. She's giving a professional development presentation called The Total 6-12 Percussion Program, Structure for Success, at 9 a.m. Friday morning in room 204. Here's Emily talking about middle school and high school percussion programs.
Emily, tell me about your PASIC session that you're about to present in a week or so.
Well, I'm really excited that my presentation was accepted by the Education Committee, because one of the things I think we need to be doing at PAS is doing a lot more outreach to educators and younger students. At least where I live and with the people that I work around, fellow percussion educators, there's an impression that PAS is a lot for college folks and drum set players. And that those of us who work in the scholastic area, which is 6-12, yeah, we have the drumline contest and we're asked to bring our kids to PASIC and they have the fundamental sessions, but we're really not doing a lot of nitty gritty work in, number one, assisting non-percussionist educators who have to teach percussion at any level of the 6-12 spectrum. And also, really having a lot of conversation, mentorship, and resources for people like me who are teaching 6-12 percussion, who are percussionists, who may also be band directors or maybe like myself, percussion specialists, which has been very, I would say, a booming line of work. So one of the things that I get asked a lot when, you know, I work in Texas band, we're pretty sort of well known in the music education world for having some really excellent ensembles. We go and play other places, or someone sees the video and sends me an email. The question I get a lot is, well, how do you how do you structure what you do? How do you know what to teach fifth graders? How do you know how to prep seventh and eighth graders for challenges at the high school? How do you get kids ready for high school drumline? How do you get your freshmen to buy into doing blah, 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 blah? So basically lots of questions about structure of percussion education across the entire spectrum. And given that I have what used to be a unique and is a less unique position now of teaching 6 or 12 percussion, I've got that experience of being able to see the whole package all at once and what it looks like as you're taking kids from one stage, the stage of first putting sticks in their hands, excuse me, to the stage of being, you know, semi-competent middle school percussionists who are able to play, you know, a Goldenberg etude and a Peters Intermediate etude and be able to play with a band and tune timpani and play percussion ensembles to high schoolers who are performing all-state etudes and full mallet solos and marching with a marching band and doing all the things that high school band students are expected to do. And many who are progressing to the collegiate level as well in various music majors and non-music majors, but music participants. And so being able to see that whole spectrum, it's easier to get a sense of what it takes to move from one level to the next, what the progression needs to be, what the goals need to be, what the checkpoints need to be. And what I'm hoping to do in this presentation is to talk about how I structure my program, how it's tailored to the programs that I work with and the structure that we have in the state of Texas, because certainly it has to work with what you're doing at your school, and how people can take some of these concepts, adapt them to their own situation, and hopefully we'll have a lot of people come and we can have a conversation and they can share what works for them and we can all walk away with a whole lot more ideas, because this doesn't need to be me pontificating for 50 minutes. I'm hoping that we'll have a lot of opportunity to just almost roundtable in a guided fashion about what works well to provide kids a really excellent percussion education from the minute they walk out the door hopefully they're not walking out the door in sixth grade. The minute they walk in the door in sixth grade to the minute that they graduate in high school, and hopefully they're in band all 7 years, and hopefully they have plans to participate in music in college and afterwards. Because that's really what we're here to do, is to help kids find ways to enjoy making music and loving music throughout their lifetime.
Great.
Sorry, that was a lot to digest at once.
It's fine. That's fine. I was thinking when you said, hopefully they're not walking out the door in sixth grade, and I thought in my head, no, that's a totally different session. Like, that's not what I'm presenting.
No, and I want to be clear, of course, band starts in different levels in different areas of the country, and some areas start fourth grade, fifth grade. Mm-hmm. I don't have a lot of experience with the elementary band, but a lot of the ideas are transformable based on whatever level you're at and whatever level you're working with. So, I'm very conceptually driven. I have certain priorities for my program. I have certain concepts and everything I do derives from those things. So certainly those concepts and those priorities are portable, and then you just adapt them for the things that you need in your own program.
Right. I mean, you've kind of answered my next thing, which was let me phrase it this way. Why have you presented on this before, and why was this to you such a pressing thing that you felt like I need to be the one to talk about this?
Well, I'll be honest. I don't necessarily, there's no hubris attached here. So
sure.
I don't care who talks about it, but nobody seemed to be talking about it. And so I thought, well, what the heck? I'll throw my hat in the ring. The worst they can say is no. Because it is a conversation that we need to be having on a regular basis. And this is a very, talking 6 or 12 percussion curriculum and curriculum design, that's pretty broad, let's be honest. I'm not going to do anything I'm not going to hand someone the answers to anything about their program. You know, here's the key to unlock everything about what frustrates you about teaching your children on, you know, in 50 minutes on Friday morning, next Friday. Again, what I hope to do is sort of open a conversation, and I hope to inspire more people to then I think we've had a lot of really specific presentations at PASIC over the years about introducing formal technique or developing rudimental approach. And at some point, it is helpful to have, you have all these ideas and you don't have a place to put them and you need a structure to hang your hat on in order to kind of go, well, how do I decide what to do today when the kids walk in the room? How do I decide to do in 2 weeks? How do I know whether I'm preparing my kids the right way? It's something more than just, well, we have a concert in 2 months, let's get ready for it. Something more than, well, they've finally finished learning B flat, so I guess we'll move on to E flat. At some point, there has to be some conversation about structure. And talking about specific materials is great, but we need to have a deeper conversation about what role those specific materials play in the overall getting from here to there. Moving from 11 years old to 18 years old. I don't know. I can't answer why me. The only reason I say why me is because no one else had. And the education committee said yes. I have not given a specific presentation before. I have talked about some of these concepts. I presented to multiple colleges here in Texas about details of the 6-12 percussion educator. And I've talked somewhat about this as a very small part of that presentation. And that presentation is also pretty enormous in scope, so I don't have a lot of chance to talk about structure and curriculum. That's certainly the starting point for what I'm going to talk about in a week and a half from now.
Are you thinking, I know you explained a little bit about how you want the session to go, are you using PowerPoint, are you demonstrating, or are you handouts, a little bit of all the above there?
I don't have any students attending with me, so I'm not planning on doing any on-the-spot demonstrations of this is how my class runs. To be honest, I'm going to start with some PowerPoint, and if I can find some videos, that'll be great as well. And I'm sure I'll have some copies of percussion ensemble programs in there and some examples of, for example, the type of all-state and all-region music we're dealing with where I teach, so that people can have some reference points for where I'm coming from with the way I've had to set things up. Because, again, everything is specific to the program you work within. But beyond that, again, I don't want to be so specific that people are walking away going, well, that seems to work great for her, but I can't do anything with any of that. So I really am hoping to be able to generate a discussion rather than give a presentation. And I'm hoping that people will really come ready with their ideas and ready to ask questions and ready to volunteer their thoughts. And it is 9 a.m. on Friday, which is not necessarily the most popular time. So it may be 10 of us sitting around with our coffee, and that's fine if that's what it ends up being. You know, we'll put the chairs in a circle and we'll just have a talk, and I'm totally cool with that.
I was thinking, in my head, I'm like, well, why don't you just, tell everybody you will have coffee at the, you will bring a pot, got some sweet and low, if you want some creamer. Found some of that. Just think about that. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, that actually is something I've thought about. If I can find an Einstein or a Starbucks and pick up a traveler, then I may do that. And people can help themselves. I would hate to promise coffee and then run out and get all sorts of disgruntled comments on my Facebook page about how I promised coffee and it wasn't. So.
Well,
so I guess if you're curious about whether there will be coffee, you'll have to come and find out.
Spread a little whisper session. She's gonna have coffee. I don't know. Is she gonna have coffee? I think so. We should go.
So, at any rate, there you go.
And last, but definitely not least, is Lamon Lawhorn. Lamon is an alum of Pete's Percussion Podcast. Check out episode 35. He's also an assistant band director and percussion instructor at North Carolina A&T State University. Lamon's research lecture and presentation on the evolution of contemporary gospel drumming will take place at 11 a.m. Friday morning in room 204, directly after Emily's presentation. Here's Lamon talking at length about his topic.
I remember last time you said you had three things that you wanted to do with PASIC, which was to present with the drum line. So you did that. And now you're doing, you still want to take a percussion ensemble, which that maybe in the future on that one. But now you've gotten the second one, which is you are presenting at PASIC.
And that's crazy. Like, it's just crazy. I was just telling a friend of mine, like, the fact that I've been on, in a calendar year, I will be on international stage three times. Like, to present at PASIC with the drum line, then do the Austrian thing, and then to come back to PASIC to do my own presentation. I never thought of myself as a researcher. I thought, you know, maybe I'll come back to PASIC to do a drum set clinic or something like that. But to know that, like, the research part of it is being, you know, accepted, that's great, which is another thing that's happened in the year. I wrote an article that was the March edition in the Percussive Notes of the evolution of contemporary gospel drumming. And so that made it in there. And so I guess this is, you know, a longer presentation or read or breakdown of what that is. And so very, very, very excited. Kind of jumped for joy when I saw the email because, you know, listening back to like Brian Zader's podcast to know how many applications go in. I serve on a drum set committee just to review all those applications that come in, you know, and this particular topic wasn't in the drumline category. It was under, drum category. It was on the research side just to know how many applications come in. And I was picked. You know, and I know people, you know, I got friends in the percussion community and they submitted, you know, plenty of presentation topics and to not be chosen and to know I'm blessed to have gotten chosen twice in 2 years. You know, it's great. It's a detriment to, I mean, it's just a testimony to say, you know, I'm just blessed. You know, I can just talk and just say, hey, if you just continue to work hard on the things that you're passionate about, you know, good things will work out for you. The presentation is the evolution of contemporary gospel drumming. This is somewhat, I feel like I'm going through my dissertation defense again, pretty much doing this presentation.
With a larger audience this time.
Yeah.
And they, you know, they're not going to question your credentials entirely like they would for a doctoral defense.
And so preparing for this, I went and just reread the whole dissertation. And oh, my God, it triggered so many things. You know? Oh, my God. I was like, no, but no more locked doors. No.
Just red marks of pages of red marks.
Oh, my God. You know, I just thought about the committee writing on, no. But it was, you know, it was just.
Measuring your margins, you know.
Yeah, it broke down good and bad memories, you know, because I have, like in my dissertation, I think I had like 40 transcriptions of gospel drumming. And I'm looking at this stuff like, what is that? You know, and just to think, like during that time, I could just rip off transcriptions. Like my ear was so sensitive at the time. I could hear just the smallest ghost note or, you know, I could decipher which tom was what. And people used to ask, how can you hear that? I just engulfed myself in that style of play and listening to so much that my ear just became so adaptive to hear whatever it was I was looking for. And so I'm going to have quite a few of those transcriptions in there. Again, this is the evolution of contemporary gospel drumming. So I traced the history of gospel drumming from 1968 to 2012. And I'm really looking, when I say contemporary gospel drumming, I'm looking to see where did the term gospel chops come from? You know, and it's personal for me for various things. Now I feel like I'm going into my presentation, you know, a little bit, but it's okay. It's like, it's personal for me because I grew up playing drums in church. So a lot of the research material I played it in church. I really wanted to know, like, where did the term gospel chops come from? Because I ran into a lot of guys who was like, yeah, I'm a gospel drummer. I got gospel chops. And I used to think, as much as I play gospel drum, I don't want to be labeled as a gospel drummer, because sometimes it gains some negative attention to it. But people used to always say, oh, you got gospel chops. And I was like, well, what exactly is gospel chops? Is it because I play drums in church, or is it because I play gospel music? What exactly is a gospel chop? So the whole thing was just trying to figure out, well, where did gospel chops, what it is considered now, where did it come from? And so I remember when I was thinking about the topic, I had a conversation with Daniel Glass at PASIC. And I was like, you know, I'm thinking about doing this thing. I know you did the book and you had all of those charts and transcriptions with Zorro. You know, where should I start? And he was like, man, it's in the music. It's in the music. The evolution and everything is in the music. So I just listened to a lot of music. And being that, you know, I had a strong history in gospel drumming, I kind of knew where to go, because I didn't want to listen to things that didn't necessarily evolve the time. So like if people were just keeping straight time, you know, that was a big thing in the 80s as far as keeping straight time, playing in the pocket. I didn't necessarily add that to the research literature, because, you know, anybody can play just 2 and 4. If I'm doing this evolution of contemporary playing, when did the difficulties start? So, you know, that's going to be something that I have to, that's a question that I get. Well, why didn't you listen to this? Or why didn't you add this to it? Well, he's just playing straight time. So that's, you know, that's not necessarily pushing everything forward. I have a category of when it was important to play straight time. But, you know, now I'm starting to hear guys play all these 32nd notes and linear fields. Let me research that and figure out how did that become gospel chops. So it's cool, you know, and I did some interviews. I got to interview Calvin Rogers. I know I talked about it. You know, he's like my drum idol. The fact that I got to talk to that guy, oh man, like that's like bucket list 101. You know, that's the thing. I also interviewed Fred Dinkins. As of late, I got to interview Gerald Hayward. I spoke with a guy named Nate Robinson. I have a close connection with him. We both went to Prairie View. He went some years ahead, but he's a drummer for Lecrae. And I also got to interview a good friend of mine named Aaron Henry. He's from Fort Worth, and he played with Tamla Mann for a few years. And the whole Tamla Mann band is from Fort Worth. They actually came through Greensboro like 2 weeks ago, and I got to catch up with some of those guys. So growing up playing with those guys is really great. You know, side note, it's kind of crazy being connected with people. Like, Tamla Mann's band came through, and I know those guys. Lecrae came just last week, and I caught up with Nate. And then one of my best friends, he's a musical director for a group called Jack and Jack. I don't know what they play necessarily, but he's coming through on a tour. You know what I mean? And I'm getting to catch up with him today. So it's just great to know that you're connected with some people. So I'll be posting 3 weekends of pictures of me playing, you know, taking pictures of people on tour. They're like, who are you? You know, I could be a touring drummer, but I chose to be Dr. Lawhorn, you know. That sounds good, too.
Of course.
Yeah, but, you know, the whole evolution of contemporary gospel drumming is great. I broke it down into 4 main categories, and that could be drum or song introductions, and you know, you can see how songs began to really evolve. The drumming in songs began to evolve with just the introduction or a song introduction, and it evolved from like a 2-beat feel to a full onslaught, you know, display of just virtuosity. Like I have one transcription of Sput when he did an opening for Kim Burrell's live album, and some friends told me they went to this recording, and that's actually the second take. The first take, like, he just floored the whole audience, and everybody was like, whoa, you know, going crazy, like, let's do that again. Like, you can't play stuff like that, you know. So I have that as one category. Another category is another category is regional or Brooklyn style fields or based fields, and that's where we talk about Gerald Hayward and Jeff Davis, how they did a lot of the rolls, like the with the foot and all of that stuff. It's pretty much double strokes between the hands and the feet. So I can show how that evolved. The third category is shout music, and I get to break that down. There's a term called protophony. And I took a hymnody course when I was at Ole Miss, and when they broke that term, I was like, what is that? Cratophony. And it was pretty much when people start shouting, you know, when the pastor's preaching and he gets the, and I heard the Lord say it, and I was like, that's just going to church for me. But, you know, growing up in church, I just never heard an actual term, cratophony. And I was like, what is that? You know, but it's a term for it. And so I break down how that music as well has evolved, because that style of play, it used to just happen by chance. Someone catch the Holy Ghost or the Spirit and they start to move, and then the musicians would play something behind them. But now in gospel music, full songs have been orchestrated and composed behind playing shout music. And so I get to show examples of that. And then the last is drum solos, reprises, and breaks. And so, you know, the first drum solo I can remember playing or hearing was Thank You, Lord by Joel Smith and Walter Hawkins, Love Center Choir. And how I know this is playing drums in church. We used to have musicals and everything. And now they played that song and I could not play that feel. I could not play that solo. And so they had to bring in somebody else, the big name guys around town, Mike Mitchell. I can remember they had him. You may have heard of Mike Mitchell Jr. Like, he's a phenomenal drummer. He's playing with Stanley Clark, I believe. Well, his dad taught me how to play. And so Mike Mitchell came in to play. And I remember seeing Mike Mitchell Jr., like, 3 years old, messing around on the drum set. But they would bring Mike Mitchell in to play those fills because I couldn't. And so when I talked to a lot of those people as far as interviews, they would go back to Joel Smith, and that play is, like, one of the first drum solos. And so going from there, I would listen to different things and listen to different songs and albums. And so I traced how drum solos have advanced. And so I start with Joe Smith and end with Calvin Rogers with this whole, like, 32-bar solo. Like, it's just amazing just to hear how it evolved. And so, and I asked, you know, like, four research questions, like, how has gospel drumming evolved? What is the influence of, like, secular music on gospel drumming? What are some of the advanced techniques that have orchestrated or taken place? And lastly, you know, what is the impact of gospel drumming on, like, artists, like popular artists and things of that nature? So, and I asked those questions because it really made me think. If you look at much of the popular artists today, such as, you know, look at Lady Gaga, if you look at Beyonce, if you look at artists such as that nature, 90% of the people that play drums for them have a background in gospel drumming. And it's like, how am I going to have that background? What makes them so easily plug and play for these type of groups, if you want to say that? Okay, so just take it, for instance, how gospel or church is now. You have a drum set player, you have a bass guitar, you have a piano player, you have a second, you know, a keyboard player, you have an electric guitar, you may have a horn section. And if somebody's been playing in this environment since age 10, by the time they get 20 and they've been playing drums, Monday you have band rehearsal, Tuesday choir rehearsal, Wednesday night service, every third Saturday you have some other rehearsal, and then you have two services on Sunday. By the time they're 20, that's close to those 10,000 hours.
Yeah, you can make the calculation right there.
Yeah, that's close to those 10,000 hours. And who would you rather get? So once you get into that environment of church, and they've been playing with tracks now, because one of those things that evolved in gospel drumming is electronics. One of the demands on drummers is to be programming. You have to play the click tracks or loops or anything like that. So once they get in that environment with the popular or secular artists, they've been doing this in church for 10 years. So who would you rather plug in that play? That person or somebody who's been, like, playing in their garage band every weekend or every 3 weekends out of the month, and, you know, they're not taking it as serious. So the field and the expertise of a gospel drummer is elevated, definitely, because they've been exposed to so much stuff. And also one of the things I break down is how gospel drummers are so exposed to so much music, and how gospel just the genre of gospel music can be so overlapping with popular music, because these musicians now listen to so much stuff, and then they bring in those same licks or feels or styles of play into gospel music to push it. And so it's not like the gospel drummer is going to get a chance to go and study this. The music director is going to say, hey, we're playing this song on Sunday. Listen to this track, and we're going to have it ready for rehearsal, you know. And so that track may have some type of Latin feel. It may have some type of reggae. It may have some type of hard rock, contemporary Christian music feel to it as well. And so as a gospel drummer, you're learning all of these styles, and you're really not aware of it. And so once you get into the realm of where you're getting paid for this professionally, you have all of these styles in you, and you don't even know. So it really prepares you to be playing on a larger platform than somebody else who doesn't have that experience. Yeah. So I'm really looking forward to this. And a big thing, another thing that I opening with is why now? And two of the points I'm making is that this is really groundbreaking. You know, as a DMA student or a PhD student, when they say write your dissertation, you're always saying, you know, I want to write something that's adding to academia. You're either taking someone else's research and going with it, or presenting something new. And so when I presented the idea of doing a dissertation on gospel drumming, there was nothing out there. All of my professors were kind of lost. They were like, I don't know much about it, but it sounds great. Move forward with it. And so I feel like there has been some research literature. There was a guy, Daniel Statnicki, out of a Canadian school, and he did something dealing with gospel drumming, but it wasn't as inclusive as this. There's been some, you know, DVDs put out. I know Spanky put out one. Aaron Spears put out one. Jeff Davis put out a DVD, but it talks about just how to play, but it doesn't talk about how you got to where you are. It doesn't talk about how the style got to where it is. And so this is really groundbreaking, because my dissertation is 200 pages, you know, and there's nothing that's been that extensive to go into the realm of gospel drumming. And to know now that the style of gospel drumming is becoming more and more acceptable in the gospel community. Like, if we look at Pasic right now, you got Eric Moore that's going to be playing. You got Nikki Glaspie that's going to be playing. You have Sput that's going to be doing a clinic. A lot of these people grew up playing drums in church. And so now that you have people with this background being presented on an international level, it's becoming more and more acceptable. And also, you look at companies like Zildjian. They have this thing called a gospel pack. You look at Sabian, they have something called an inspirational pack. That's targeted specifically for gospel drummers. And if you talk to a lot of company representatives, they say they're really making a lot of their money from either drums or cymbals or whatever on gospel guys, because we're the ones, or they're the ones, buying the equipment. So just think about this. If I'm a musician, and I go to my pastor and I say, hey, we need new cymbals. He's like, what do you need? Well, I need this 18-inch A-Custom Crash. I need another 17-inch K-Custom Hybrid. I need a 21-inch, right? What do you need? Or I say, hey, we need cymbals. What do you need? Well, Zildjian has his gospel pack. Oh, a gospel pack? Really? I think that'll enhance our worship. Go ahead and get that gospel pack. You know, so it's all marketing and things like that just for gospel drummers. So to say that we gospel drummers, or the term gospel drumming or gospel chops, or just the genre of gospel and the drummers within it aren't making an impact on the community, that would definitely be false.
Are you incorporating PowerPoint? Are you using like video clips? Are you playing yourself to demonstrate? What's the plan on this?
Yeah, I will be doing all three. The main presentation is PowerPoint. Like, I haven't gotten into what is that. I know there's another, you know, more interactive way of doing a presentation. I forgot the system, whatever, but I've never used that. I guess you call me old school. Let me do point clicks PowerPoint. Mm-hmm. So I'll be doing PowerPoint. I have some of the audio from the interviews in there. At the very beginning, I don't want to insult people's intelligence, but I give the I give a lot of the reading from the screen as far as the information up there, as far as methods, how I categorize stuff. Then once I break down, I start with the early years. And then once I get into the early years, that's when it'll be more me talking, explaining things going on. I have clips of the audio from the interviews. I have some YouTube clips that help better explain some things. And then I'm gonna pass out handouts of the transcriptions. And then I'm also gonna play the transcriptions during the category. So there may be like four or five transcriptions for each category that I talked about: the drum and solo, the regional bass fills, the shout music, and the drum introductions. And so then I'm trying to wrap this up fairly quickly, well, within like maybe like 40 minutes, so that I leave time for question and answer.
Mm-hmm. Or to just lay down a sick pocket and just have people talk over it. Right?
Yeah, and I'm going to play just a little bit. And when I say just a little bit, maybe two or three examples, because, you know, even though I love to do my own drum set clinic, this is not a drum set clinic, and I don't want, and they put that in the, you know, the lines for lecture, you know, don't try to sneak this in to where you're doing a lecture, but you're playing for 40 minutes. You know, that's not what's happening. I'm really being a lecturer with some small examples. I think I'll do like examples of like linear fills, and then I'll do examples of like shout music, because shout music is pretty much, I refer it to as a jazz bass line. Boom, 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 boom. And so I'm going to break down how, if you play, it's very slow, you can swing, and this is pretty much shout music. But once you add the tempo, it's a two-beat fast. And then to show some variations of like bell or ride rhythms that you can play in patterns and stuff like that. But it's not, I'm not going to be doing a whole track of 5 minutes and, you know, no, that's not going to happen. Maybe in the next 4 years, you know, if you're listening, pace the committee, I'll submit some stuff.
I made a joke that I decided not to post, but you had put when I saw the frame of you with the drum set, I was like, is your drum set going to evolve? Because you only have like three drums on it.
It was just for pictures, you know.
Yeah.
But I'm really trying to play less or play a smaller drum set. Like in a lot of my videos, I try to change setups because, you know, I don't want to get stuck in everything being muscle memory one way, you know, and I only play one way. So I added a second hi-hat, but now I don't think I'll ever play again without two hi-hats because I just fall in love with playing like that. But, you know, I'm a Pearl artist and was signed on with Pearl over the last summer. So I was I got to purchase a studio session series kit, and it's like a 7-piece. So but it's rare that I ever set up with all four toms. So I either go from three toms and with a 16-inch floor tom, or just do a 10 and a 16. I try to play all different genres of music. So if I play a rock piece, I'll do like 12-inch tom and a 16, or 12, 14, 16, you know. So I'm always trying to evolve my own playing and not just, you know, do one thing. So yeah, the drum set will evolve, and then sometimes I just break it down to the bare minimum and see how many voicings, you know, I can get out of just kick, snare, hi-hat.
Yeah. I mean, because we haven't discussed your career in the Tool cover band that you're in. So, you know, I just figured, you know, we didn't want to tell people about that because nobody ever sees any pictures of Tool. So I assume that nobody ever sees the pictures of the Tool cover band either.
You know, we try to keep that under wraps, you know what I mean? But since the cat's out of the bag, you know, I've been touring drummers, you know, for, you know, no years, but that's okay. You know?
That would be awesome if you just all of a sudden you decide to play the solo from 46 and 2.
No, it's not going to be me. Not at all.
Many thanks to Gwen, Haley, Emily, and Lamon for talking to me for this show. I do hope you can catch their presentations, if you can. Additionally, I hope you caught me saying in the beginning of the show, snippets of conversation. All four of today's guests will appear on a future standalone episode of the podcast, to be aired sometime after PASIC. Stay tuned. because this is PASIC week and I have already raved about going to the conference last week, I'll instead just wish everyone safe travels to and from Indianapolis. And also, if you can do something like this, put it on your schedule too.
So maybe we can catch up and bother somebody doing their dissertation research, you know?
Or yeah, absolutely.
Maybe we can interrupt somebody studying for their comps like you did, Brian.
Yes, absolutely. I'd be more than happy to do that again. I'm glad that was awesome. We were just remembering that was hilarious. He's like, I had totally forgotten about that. I'm like, I know.
I don't know. I don't know if I'd have been as cordial, you know.
Oh yeah, yeah.
In the middle of everything, like, hey man, like I'm really trying to get this support. Yeah.
And that's it for today's show. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and leave a comment and a rating. Show notes are always found on the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes. The show is also on SoundCloud and Stitcher. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can contact me there, on Twitter at Pete Zambito, or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com, and I will catch you next time, or hopefully in Indianapolis. Until then.